This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America and immigration. Illegal immigration has made the southern border a lightning rod for fiery political debate. How is that shaping the upcoming election, and how might the outcome impact America's neighbors to the south? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, welcome to this Moneybox podcast. Can the growing network of banking hubs ever replace the 6,000 closed bank branches? Will the Chancellor's choices on savings and dividend taxes be tough on people who've provided for their retirement? And gas and electricity are more expensive from Tuesday. Should you fix the cost now? But first, a widowed mother with two children who works in a residential care home in West London has told this programme she's being punished if she works longer hours. Aurora, that's not her real name, gets universal credit to top up her low income. But she's told Moneybox if she earns more than a certain amount, she loses free school meals for her two boys and free prescriptions for herself. And if she earns above another limit, her universal credit is also cut. This can leave her worse off and, as she put it, trapped. Aurora's a real-life example of the problems faced by working families on low incomes, which are highlighted in a new report from the Institute for Policy Research at the University of Bath. Moneybox's Dan Whitworth here with the details. Dan.
Well, this report was funded by the Financial Fairness Trust, which campaigns for low-income households and, indeed, people like Aurora. Now, she works with an online project called Changing Realities to document what life is like for parents and carers on low incomes. And she told me the impact of this earnings threshold on her and her two boys.
I've cut back on lunches and try to not let the children know about my financial difficulties, but it's quite hard. And what can we do about it? It's been really difficult. It's really hard because the system, in a way, is designed to punish us for working too little, from working too much. I mean, in a way, I would have to earn a ridiculous amount of money to come out of benefits. Because of the expensive rent in London, we are essentially trapped.
Now, the cost of that rent is £1,850 per month for a small house in West London. Now, that's where she's from, that's where she works, and her family lives nearby. Because that's covered by her benefits, it makes it nearly impossible for Aurora to work and work and work, because on minimum wage, she'd never earn enough to cover her rent and even the most basic living costs for her and her two boys. As it is, because of having to look after her children, she's able to work up to 28 hours per week in a care home. That means she earns too much to qualify for additional means-tested help like free school meals, free prescriptions and help with council tax, which actually means she'd be financially better off if she worked less.
It's a difficult situation because the system isn't really fit for purpose. Although we are working, we are still beaten with a stick, as it were. It's not enough. As I move on, as my youngest becomes older, I will be asked to work more, which is fair enough. But at what cost? Try not to think about it anymore, because there's no way I can get out of this trap.
Aurora explaining the real-world impact of the benefit system on her. Dr. Rita Griffiths from the University of Bath's Institute for Policy Research is one of the authors of the report that Dan referred to. Earlier, I asked her what was wrong with the way universal credit interacts with schemes like free school meals, council tax reduction and free prescriptions.
Very few people in our sample were eligible for the schemes because they had earnings. And this was because of the very low earnings thresholds which apply to the different schemes. So this is the amount of money that you're allowed to earn before you lose entitlement. So, for example, for free school meals, the annual earnings threshold is £7,400 per annum for new claimants. for free prescriptions, it's £435 per month. And not only are the earnings limits very low, but what this means is just earning just a pound more above the threshold means that you can lose your entitlement in its entirety.
Yes, I mean, Aurora says the system is designed to punish her. She says she feels beaten with a stick. But actually, it surprises me because it was supposed to be designed to encourage people, not just back into work, but to earn more. 2 million people do work on universal credit, don't they?
That's exactly right. The issue about these schemes is that they actually sit outside universal credit. So they're administered and assessed separately by a range of government departments and agencies, utility providers, and they all have different rules and regulations around eligibility criteria and earnings thresholds. So they're all different. There's no coherence. And also, because these schemes are additional to universal credit, they're withdrawn additionally.
Yes, I mean, Aurora told Dan that she needed to be an accountant and had to check everything every month to make sure she didn't lose things. Because not everyone can cope with that, can they? What changes would you like to see?
So increasing the earnings thresholds, the very low earnings thresholds for these schemes, would make a difference. Also, looking at universal credit itself, so reducing the amount of the taper so that people get to keep more of their earnings, and also extending work allowances. So work allowances, some people are entitled to earn a certain amount of money before the taper is applied. So at the moment, that's just working families with children. And people with disabilities who have limited capability for work.
How would these changes be paid for? Because the more money people on benefits get, surely the less money the Treasury has.
The government wants people to work. These people want to work. They want to improve their living standards. They want to earn more. But at the moment, they're trapped because these additional earnings can mean that they're financially worse off. So the system itself is working against people, and that needs to be addressed. And the schemes can stop these working families from sliding into poverty, and that's got to be a good thing. These people will be paying taxes and contributing to society more generally.
Is it possible, if somebody earns more or perhaps returns to work, gets a job, that they will end up worse off than if they were just on benefits?
I mean, there was one example where a woman moved back into work after maternity leave, and first a letter landed on the doormat saying that she'd lost her reduction to council tax. Then another one saying I'd lost free school meals. Then another one saying that I'd lost entitlement to Health Start vouchers. And then another one saying that I'd lost entitlement to a school uniform grant. She could not afford to work. She said, we're actually worse off by me working.
Now, I know you're not the only organisation calling for these changes. The Institute for Fiscal Studies, the Resolution Foundation have all come up with similar ideas. And you yourself have given evidence, haven't you, to MPs? You've been in Westminster and talked to people. Do you have any sense that your calls for these changes will be heeded?
I think the Department for Work and Pensions is very receptive. But one of the key issues is that they are not in control of a lot of these schemes because they're administered by other government departments. They're very limited in terms of what they themselves can do, which is why government itself needs to take a more strategic view of these schemes. So as part of the review of universal credit, we're urging the government to include consideration of these schemes and also as part of the new child poverty strategy as well.
Dr. Rita Griffiths from the University of Bath, and Dan's still with us. What's the government had to say about this, Dan?
Well, it told me it's committed to supporting low-income families by extending the Household Support Fund by £421 million. It went on to say, as well as our commitment to reviewing universal credit so people receive the support they need, we are taking action to help people into work and break down the barriers to opportunity.
Dan, thanks very much. 6,000 bank branches have been closed in the last 9 years. Some are being replaced by what are called banking hubs. One high street shop where money can be paid in and taken out, and several banks have a presence there for more complicated things for at least some of the week. But the number of banking hubs is yet to reach 100. More are planned, but there are calls this week for banks to improve the services they offer. That call comes from Charles Randall of the Financial Inclusion Commission. Now, Charles is with me in the studio, but before I talk to him, let's hear from some customers in a banking hub in Prestatyn, talking to our reporter Joe Krasner.
Can you tell me why you're here today?
I want to transfer some money to a bank account in France.
I come all the way from Denby, so I've had to travel here.
I came to transfer some money, so I do international banking.
And what do you think of this facility?
Oh, I think it's fabulous.
So you've just had your meeting with mm-hmm. the bank representative. How useful was that?
Very useful indeed. Very quick service. Yeah.
Have you used a banking hub before?
I've used this one about three or four times in the last month. It's quite handy, really. It's a shame that the bank I was with has closed down, but this does the same thing.
All I do is basic, and so I find it very good.
Is there any other facility that you'd like them to provide here?
My password on my computer. My email address had changed, and they couldn't do it here. That's good to the bank.
With all the banks online, we don't have any banks. I hope they don't close this one as well, you know. It's very, very helpful.
With it being a one-day operation for most of them, that can be a bit inconvenient for people.
I just needed simply three-month statements printed out, and I've been told I've had to order them. It could take up to 7 days or go somewhere else. Not being rude, it's not the lady's fault, but it's like I'm changing my bank to a building site on the High Street within the next half an hour.
Shoppers in Prestatyn talking to Joe Krasner. Well, as I said, Charles Randall is with me. Charles Randall, the Financial Inclusion Commission that you sit on wants everyone to have equal access to the financial services they need. But why are banking hubs needed? Branches are closing because so many people bank online.
Yeah, that's right. And clearly online banking is fantastic for a lot of people, gives them 24/7 access to their banking services. But there are large groups of people who still depend on cash. And there are groups of people, often elderly, disabled, living in rural areas, sometimes perhaps on low incomes because of that, who need that face-to-face service.
Now, you can do a lot of things there. You can pay in and take out, but money out, and some people rely on checks, don't they? And it's very handy to be able to pay a check in like that. But you can do all that in post offices. What do banking hubs offer for financial inclusion that a post office can't?
Well, what they offer is a bit more privacy than you would get in many post offices. I think anyone who's had to deal with a personal matter in a post office is conscious of the fact that there's usually a large queue of people around them. And what you can get in a banking hub is a face-to-face interview with your community banker from your bank, provided that they participate in the banking hub.
Yes, and provided they're there, because one of the things that we heard when we were talking to the people in Prestatyn is that their bank was only there one day a week, or some cases half a day a week. So you've got to time it so your bank is there, haven't you? That seems a restriction. And then we heard from the couple, they'd come from Denby. That's over an hour's journey. And others wanted to print out bank statements but couldn't. What services would you like them to provide for these 7-odd million people who aren't online?
Well, I'd first like to say it's great that we've got them. Well done, Cash Access UK, for rolling them out. It's really good to see the rate of them being rolled out increasing, and it's great that some very large banks are supporting this. But you're right. I think on days when the banker isn't there, there may be queries that need to be dealt with anyway, and we should start thinking about the future and turning this into a bit more of a utility operation.
Doing what, though? Doing what that they don't do now?
So, for example, if you go into a banking hub and your community banker isn't there, but you've got a problem with a fraud or a scam, you're very worried about it, and it's urgent, I think we should expect that somebody in the banking hub will help you with it.
And what about online access? Because a lot of the people who aren't online need a bit of help to get online. Can you go to a banking hub and be helped to download your bank's app and, you know, do all that
so
you have to do?
Your community banker will help you with some of that. But again, that's one of the things where I think there's potential to turn these community hubs into digital access hubs as well, and to provide a service 5 days a week where you can go and get specialist advice on how to convert to digital.
Yes. UK Finance, which of course represents the bank, says there is significant investment going into banking hubs, and I believe there's a plan for 350 by the end of this parliament. That's, what, 50 a year or so on top of what we got. Is that enough?
Well, the 350 is a target that's been set by the Labour government. I'm really pleased that Tulip Sadiq, the Economic Secretary to the Treasury, has got right behind this. I would be astonished if we don't see a large overshoot of that number. And I think by the end of this parliament, I'm pretty confident we'll see a lot more.
Now, Cash Access UK, which I think you mentioned, operates the banking hubs, and it says it's going to work with member banks to see how it can make them what it calls even better. If banking hubs don't improve, briefly, can they be made to do better? Very briefly.
Well, I'm always in favour of carrots rather than sticks, and I think that banks won't want to get to that point. But yes, if they're not delivering what communities need, then there's always the risk that legislation will be introduced.
Charles Randall of the Financial Inclusion Commission, thanks very much for talking to us. Each week on Moneybox, we've been looking what tax changes Chancellor Rachel Reeves could make to reduce what she calls the £22 billion black hole in the government's finances left by their predecessors. One idea being mentioned is reducing tax breaks for savers, perhaps capping the amount you can put into a tax-free ISA or raising the tax rates on the dividends which companies pay to shareholders. At the moment, you can put up to £20,000 into a tax-free ISA every year, and more than 20 million people have an ISA. More than 4,000 are said to have over £1 million in one. Outside an ISA, of course, dividends can be tax-free, but only now up to £500. That's fallen from the first £5,000 in 2016. Moneybox listener Julia emailed us. She and her husband are pensioners, partly supported by dividends on their investments.
The tax-free allowance on dividends before you begin to pay tax has reduced substantially. It's gone down 90% over 8 years, and maybe it was too generous to begin with, but that's a big change. We prioritized investing in our future to make sure that we were financially secure. And now when we look at what we may be facing as far as taxation, when we try to, you know, realize the benefits of those investments, it feels a bit like we should have just had nicer cars and more holidays and just spent more of the money, you know, back then, instead of thinking to the future and thinking, well, you know, we want to make sure that we're financially secure when we're not working anymore.
With us now is Helen Thornley. She's a technical officer at the Association of Taxation Technicians. Helen Thornley, let's start with dividends. Some of the income from them is tax-free on top of the normal tax-free allowances. Could that be cut? Because Julia's worried, you know, these things might affect her.
Yes, it could well be cut, but I think in practice I'd be surprised, because actually it's a really welcome administrative simplification. HMRC doesn't get told about dividend income, unlike savings income, where banks and building societies tell them each year. So if you were to cut that £500, you'd be bringing a lot of people with very small amounts of dividend into the tax system, which is costly for HMRC, and they wouldn't be getting much tax back.
No, well, that's hopeful for people like Julia then. But what about the tax rates? Because I think there are around 4 million people have dividends from shares, and their income on dividends is taxed at lower rates than earned incomes, a few percentage points less. Could that tax on dividends be raised to match earned income?
Potentially, yes. The basic rate for dividends is 8.75% and the higher rate is 33.75%, which compares to 20 or 40% for sort of saving for other income. But there is a double tax, because dividends are paid out of companies' profits after they've paid corporation tax.
Yes, that's
so
always the argument
for
not raising them, isn't it? But anyway, like everything else we're talking about today, we're going to have to say wait and see. Now, tax can be avoided on dividends by investing them through an ISA, can't it? £20,000 a year can be put in one. And Treasury Minister Tulip Siddique said in Liverpool this week the government wanted to, as she put it, simplify the ISA landscape. Might that mean maybe cutting that or changing things?
Potentially. The simplest thing would be to cut what people can put in. So currently the maximum is 20,000. But that wouldn't give them much of an immediate revenue benefit. It'd be a while, because essentially it would take a number of years before the effect of getting smaller amounts into that tax-free environment led to more tax for the revenue.
It has been suggested, hasn't it, that maybe, I mean, I mentioned the 4,000 people who are said to have £1 million in their ISA. It might be that they cut the amount of in an ISA that is actually earning dividends or tax or interest tax-free. That could bring in quite a lot.
I think that could, but it'd be quite complicated to do, because people often have more than one ISA. So you'd have to allocate that cap across potentially a number of different products. So it might be simpler to put a cap on the income and gains that you could make across your ISA, because systems exist for ISA providers to report income and gains to HMRC if they needed to.
Yeah, so they could do that. So that's one of the things. I mean, that's not exactly simplifying the ISA landscape.
No, it's certainly not simplification.
It's complexifying it. Now, I mean, the other suggestion is that they'll get rid of this GB ISA that the last government wanted. You think that's going to go? I've heard it will, and then Tulip Sadiq said it hasn't been decided yet.
Yeah, I don't know on that, because at the moment we already have four types of ISA, so introducing a fifth, and of course we've got junior ISAs. If we're suddenly having six different types of ISA to consider, it's not really helping on simplification, is it?
No, it certainly isn't. And there is a sort of more general point here, isn't there? I mean, Julia was worried, and I must say I've had emails and tweets along similar lines, that she and her husband have actually been penalised for saving and investing. Lots of people do say that to us. They say, what's the point of saving if we're going to be taxed when we come to use it in retirement? It's the best form of tax avoidance just to spend your money when you get it.
Well, it's probably the most fun way of doing it. But of course, goods and services all have VAT added onto them. So I'm afraid HMRC will get you coming or going.
Yes. But of course, if you do give it away and you live, seven years, then it avoids inheritance tax if you're liable to pay it.
Yes. And that is the sort of thing when I did inheritance tax planning that we used to discuss with people a lot.
Giving it away now. I'm sure children love that, don't they? Anyway, thanks very much, Helen Thornley from the Association of Taxation Technicians. Now, the Treasury, of course, wouldn't comment on budget speculation. But on Wednesday, Moneybox Live with Felicity Hannah, who will comment on budget speculation, she'll be answering listeners' questions on personal taxes like inheritance tax and pensions tax relief, things we've discussed on the programme and how they might change. You can email your questions and thoughts to moneybox@bbc.co.uk and leave a number if you can. The price of gas and electricity will go up on Tuesday, that's October the 1st. The new price cap set by the regulator Ofgem will mean a rise of 10% in the average bill, more than wiping out the 7% reduction last July. My Newsroom reporter Catherine Lund is here. Catherine, remind listeners how this price cap works, because it's not a cap on your total bill, is it?
No. The energy price cap is set every 3 months, and what Ofgem actually set is a cap on the maximum price that can be charged for each unit of energy for domestic customers on a standard tariff for a typical household with gas and electricity who pay by direct debit. Now, that typical bill will go up by £149 to just over £1,700.
But for individuals, for each of us, it depends what we use, doesn't it?
It does. The size of your home, how many people live there, how energy efficient your home is, and whether people have medical needs will all affect how much energy you use, and so how much your bill will actually be.
Now, with these rising costs, it's going up on Tuesday. Is it worth taking out a fixed price deal?
Well, fixed rate tariffs weren't available when energy costs were soaring, but now some fixed rate deals are back. But it's complicated, and it will depend on your circumstances. Here's what Emily Seymour, energy editor at Which, says you might look at.
As a rule of thumb, we'd recommend looking around for deals that are around about the price of the current price cap, so the one that we've just had from July to September, not longer than 12 months and without significant exit fees, because they can really limit you if you did want to back out at some stage.
Now, a fixed price tariff even does give you certainty, but it is a gamble on future prices, so you do need to think carefully.
And Catherine, what if you find your energy bill really hard to pay?
Always contact your supplier in the first instance. They can offer help to people in difficulties.
Thanks very much, Catherine. And talking of energy, Dan has dashed back into the studio with an update on fraud. Sit down, Dan, and tell us.
OK, Paul. So last week we mentioned the new rules on reimbursing fraud victims, which begin a week on Monday, and that the maximum amount which could be refunded to victims was likely to be cut to £85,000 from a planned £415,000. Well, the decision has been announced and it will be...
Yes, get on with it. Don't keep us in suspense.
OK, as expected, it will be £85,000 from when the new rules begin on 7th October.
Well, thanks, Dan. And those new rules should be good news for people who have money stolen from their bank accounts from the 7th of October. And the Saturday before that, we'll explain more in our special fraud programme, including a live interview with the man in charge of the change, all of it broadcast live from the atrium in our Salford studios. Email us about that or anything else on moneybox@bbc.co.uk. We do read them all. You might get on the show. In this podcast, the reporters were Dan Whitworth, Catherine Lund and Joe Krasner, researcher Emma Smith, studio manager Glenn Hunt. Our editor is Jess Quayle. I'm Paul Lewis, and this was a BBC News Money and Work production for BBC Sounds. And now, how could anyone hate Mariana Spring?
It's election time in the United States, but this is social media's world, and the election is just living in it.
Accurate information about elections, unfortunately, is not as entertaining as false information.
Join me, Mariana Spring, as I uncover how life online is shaping American people and American politics.
None of us know what's going on, but we do all know that something isn't right.
Deepfakes, polarizing algorithms, hate, and conspiracy theories.
To me, there's no other logical explanation. That entire thing was staged.
Why Do You Hate Me, USA? From BBC Radio 4. Listen now on BBC Sounds.
ServiceNow unterstützt Ihre Business-Transformation mit der KI-Plattform. Alle reden über KI, aber die KI ist nur so leistungsfähig wie die Plattform, auf der sie aufbaut. Lassen Sie die KI arbeiten, für alle. Beseitigen Sie Reibung und Frustration Ihrer Mitarbeiter und nutzen Sie das volle Potenzial Ihrer Entwickler. Mit intelligenten Tools für Ihren Service, um Kunden zu begeistern. All das auf einer einzigen Plattform. Deshalb funktioniert die Welt mit ServiceNow. Mehr auf servicenow.de/AI4People.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America and immigration. Illegal immigration has made the southern border a lightning rod for fiery political debate. How is that shaping the upcoming election? And how might the outcome impact America's neighbors to the south? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.